It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, like it or not, bugs are all over the place, crawling through our lawns, basements, and even our culture. A Wisconsin entomologist celebrates the relationship between bugs and human art. Now, the House January 6th committee called a surprise session yesterday. The witness was Cassidy Hutchinson, a former White House aide who worked for former President Trump's last chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Hutchinson's testimony included, among other things, telling committee members that then-President Trump wanted to lead the crowd to the Capitol and that he was aware that his supporters in the crowd were armed before a speech in which he told them to fight like hell. We're talking about yesterday's January 6th hearings, what we've learned thus far, and what could come out of it all. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the testimony from yesterday, to the whole sequence of events so far? What do you think as you look back on January 6th, 2021? What questions do you still want to see answered? Who do you want to answer those questions under oath? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alisa Von Hagel is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin Superior. Alisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into yesterday's hearing in particular, big picture, what have you made so far of these January 6th committee hearings?
Well, I think these hearings have been really different from hearings before. They've really done a very purposeful job of each particular day's hearings having a message, a beginning, middle, end. There's, you know, not the grandiose political speech making that often happens that takes up a lot of time, but it's very clear, direct to the point, and it paints a really clear and stark picture of, you know, what it is that the message is that they're trying to send about one particular facet of this larger set of issues that they are investigating.
They sometimes read, and some other political scientists have mentioned this, like a prosecution in some ways, but this is, of course, not a prosecutorial body. What do you see as the, I guess, intended audience of all this? The public, the Justice Department, who?
I think all of the above. I think primarily they, you know, the intention is to ensure that the American people are informed, are aware of the, you know, the incredible investigations that they have done, all of the documents, phone records, testimonials that they have gone through for months and months, and to provide a very clear and definitive picture of what happened. Certainly, I think you're also correct that it's also, you know, whether or not they decide to make a criminal referral to the Justice Department is yet unclear, but certainly that they will be painting a picture, you know, with that in mind, clearly, as the hearings continue to, you know, set the stage for a very clear, definitive reasoning behind a referral, if they intend to do so.
Now, turning to yesterday's surprise hearing, there wasn't one planned originally. There weren't going to be any till after the July 4th holiday. They added this one with Cassidy Hutchinson, not a household name until yesterday, I think, a former aide, a deputy to then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Can you help us understand the value of her testimony and her perspective?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, to anybody who heard any part of her testimony or read anything about it, it was really stark, very shocking, truly shocking for even amongst, you know, well-seasoned politicos who have seen and, you know, heard everything under the sun. I think that yesterday's testimony was, you know, jaw-dropping, which I think I read in multiple places in different news articles. And so she was an aide. So she had the, you know, window into all of the goings on behind the scenes in the White House. She was interacting with all of these major or top staffers that we hear a lot about, but have most of them anyways, have thus far not met with the committee for a hearing or for a testimony. And so she was able to give kind of that, the big picture look, but also exact examples, even speech, even, you know, comments that people made to kind of fill in the gaps that were still, I think, left with before her participation.
And she was careful, I think, to say, you know, when she was there first person hearing something from someone versus she heard somebody else say this about something else. I want to turn to one of her, what she presented as a first person experience. This is just before former President Trump's speech at the Eclipse in D.C., saying that the president was aware that members of the crowd had weapons. Here she is talking about that.
I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
The mags being magnetometers, used as weapon detectors in this case. Elisa, people have pointed toward this as arguably the most significant part of that, the idea that the president was aware that at least some of the people gathered were armed before he sent them to the Capitol, saying they should fight like hell. That's been interpreted as, you know, political speech, you know, fight for what you believe in. The suggestion that the president was aware of weapons, though, why is that getting focus?
I mean, I think that's crucial to the overall picture of what they're painting about the event, but also with that particular scenario that she addressed here, but also with other examples of interactions with other top staffers, it was clear that, you know, the president, the former president, as well as his staffers knew that January 6th had the potential to become violent. And this particular example on that day where he clearly had, you know, known that there were people with the whole array of weaponry that people had assembled and wanted them to continue on to the Capitol was, again, reinforcing this larger, you know, idea that they had known well in advance that this could be violent and that almost it seems as if or implies as if that there was an intention or purpose behind that in terms of letting them go through to the Capitol with all of these weapons.
Talking to Elisa von Hagel from UW-Superior, political science professor there, looking at the latest testimony in front of the January 6th Commission in the U.S. House. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, or reactions. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to another moment yesterday. Hutchinson said that White House counsel Pat Cipollone was worried about the president breaking the law even before January 6th. Here's Hutchinson.
Please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol, Cassidy. Keep in touch with me. We're going to get charged with every crime imaginable if we make that movement happen. In the days leading up to the 6th, we had conversations about potentially obstructing justice or defrauding the electoral count.
So she was quoting there Pat Cipollone at the outset. Concerns raised before January 6th about people involved in the efforts on January 6th risking being charged with various crimes. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So there have been a number of different potential crimes that would be in play with this whole, you know, these whole events. And as she noted, the obstruction of justice, of attempting to conspire to defraud the electoral count is, you know, this would certainly be an indication that there was, you know, an attempt to obstruct the process by which the Congress was, you know, supposed to be conducting during that time period. And so if in fact the president was, you know, not only well aware of this, but also planning on marching on down to the Capitol himself to be present at this event, it seems to provide that it would provide intent which is necessary for this obstruction charge to have any merit in a court of law.
We're talking to Elisa von Hagel about highlights from yesterday's January 6th hearings and what we've learned so far in the series of hearings. Elisa is a political science professor at UW-Superior. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the hearings? What are you still hoping to hear? What do you hope, if anything, comes out of all of this? Or do you think it's time to be done? Yesterday in particular, what stood out to you in Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony yesterday, a deputy to then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about yesterday's January 6th hearings, where new details were revealed about what Trump officials knew leading up to the attack. We're covering some of the key points with Elisa von Hagel, political science professor at UW-Superior, and you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions, and what you want to know. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. I want to talk about kind of shifting attitudes, Elisa, toward the events of January 6th from in the moment to now, especially from House Republicans. Just that they played a couple clips yesterday that spoke to the immediacy of the event, I think. First of all, I want to give a listen to Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy talking to CBS on January 6th, 2021.
I completely condemn the violence in the Capitol. What we're currently watching unfold is un-American. I am disappointed. I'm sad. This is not what our country should look like. This is not who we are. This is not the First Amendment. This has to stop, and this has to stop now.
And Mike Gallagher, Republican congressman from Wisconsin, put out a statement in the midst of the events on January 6th.
Mr. President, you have got to stop this. You are the only person who can call this off. Call it off. The election is over. Call it off. This is bigger than you. It's bigger than any member of Congress. It is about the United States of America, which is more important than any politician.
Lisa, how has the conversation changed since the midst of those events and the urgency we just heard there?
I think that there has been a subtle shift with these hearings. While certainly, the ardent supporters of Donald Trump are, less inclined to agree with or believe what is being presented as of right now. But there has been a subtle shift in terms of the acknowledgement of the events of what had happened. The committee, beginning with the, I believe on the day one of the hearings, airing the footage from the Capitol, footage that has yet been unseen, and really illustrating very clearly, point blank, to the audience of the extreme violence that had occurred, really helps to deflate the arguments that, it wasn't a violent incursion or insurrection. It was simply, as was mentioned, a First Amendment attempt at political speech. And so with all of these things coming out, there is slowly and, surely this chipping away at the arguments that this event has not been violent and with the intent to overturn American democratic procedures.
Let's go to our callers now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. Your guest referenced a part of what my question would be. I'm wondering, for the ardent Trump supporters, if there is any data accumulated yet as to if they believe the content of the hearings, and two, if they do believe it, if they don't care.
Tom, thanks for the call. Elisa, I don't know that this is necessarily moving the needle for one group or another.
Correct. And that's a very good point. And I think both are perhaps simultaneously often the case true, that either it's just simply rejected outright, or while at the same time, a lot of times these statements or claims or even evidence that's presented, it's just simply do not care. And it's really unclear, again, how much of that base, that strong support base that he has, remains, and how much has shifted. But certainly his polling has continued to decline over time. And so even for a post-election anyways. And so perhaps there is that slow chipping away, but I do agree with the caller that both of those scenarios is often the case.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We'll go to Jim now in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I believe this is just another political game, much like the Russian collusion thing. It's really not sinking into anybody out here in the real world. It's just terrible that they're just worried that Donald Trump will win again, because right now the Gallup poll shows he would win against Biden in a matchup, even now, after all the slander, after all the abuse he's taken in the media. And I think it's just an effort to keep him from not winning, or anybody else that's, you know, like him, to win the election, because they know it's inevitable.
Jim, thanks for the call. Elisa, what do you think?
I heard Adam Schiff, who's a member of this committee, in an interview just recently, and he had stated that, you know, the purpose here for him was about American democracy. And, you know, and maybe this is, you know, grandiose, you know, speech making, of course, but that the intent was to ensure that our democratic procedures, which, you know, very well may be threatened in coming elections, are precious, are critical. And it is critical for the American public to be informed on these matters of what has just happened so that it doesn't happen again. And certainly, you know, there's obviously, you know, thinking forward to the midterm elections that could very well be part of it in terms of the hearings themselves. So there's multiple, I think there's multiple reasons behind the decisions to go ahead with the hearings on the part of the committee itself.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Elisa von Hagel, professor of political science at UW-Superior, looking at the January 6th commission hearings, including the one yesterday. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Katie is with us now in Hudson. Katie, hi.
Hi. Say, I want to hear more about something that was brought up at the debate when Trump responded to a question about the Proud Boys. And he said, Proud Boys, stand down, but stand by. I want to hear if there is any evidence or connection that they have been colluding about this for some time.
Katie, thanks for the call. Elisa, a number of members of the Proud Boys have been charged, some convicted, related to January 6th. Do you see the commission looking for connections between the president, some of his closest advisors, some in the war room at a nearby hotel, and groups like the Proud Boys?
I do think that in terms of the top staffers, particularly, as you mentioned, at the Willard Hotel meeting the day before, that there were interactions amongst people who were at the event themselves, who were part of, you know, creating this violence, and with, you know, White House officials, is, you know, documented, is clear. Whether or not Donald Trump himself personally, whether there's evidence if he himself was involved in, you know, interacting or, you know, talking about this upcoming event, it's unclear at this point. However, it is clear that there has been connections between White House staffers and some of these leaders in Proud Boys, Oath Takers, and others who were taking part in the insurrection.
Katie, thanks for that call. Rob joins us now in La Crosse. Hi, Rob.
Hey, my comment is basically echoing a caller from before. I'm a Republican, and I was disgusted by seeing the violence on TV against everyone involved. But the most important thing is that I believe it's what's happening is a kind of a charade in terms of what the Democratic Party is not doing to actually address what is important and what America cares about. I really feel like what they're doing is not sincere. And I'm tired of everyone who's a Trump supporter being called a white supremacist. I mean, would Democrats want to be called homosexuals or whatnot every time they're referenced? That's all I have to say.
Rob, thanks for the call. Rob, seeing this as a distraction in some ways from big issues, Elisa.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, I think the persons on the committee are very aware of this, you know, potential criticism before, you know, planning and orchestrating the event itself. And so that is why I believe that the, you know, the hearings themselves were, you know, not simply a reiteration of what people already have known, but it's, you know, certainly these events are things that are known about. However, the evidence, the witness testimonials, the documentation involved is something, you know, that they have presented, that they have collected and analyzed as a committee, is something well beyond what, you know, what has been known previously. And so they are very, you know, conscious of this, you know, criticism. And clearly the you know, the hearings themselves were put together in such a way as to illustrate that it is much more than what has been commonly, you know, reported upon or talked about in the media about the events of this time.
Time for one more caller. Bill is with us in Cameron. Bill, hi.
Hello. Yes, this is Bill. Previous callers have talked about CARE, some referencing CARE of the Nation about this issue. And then another one thought that it's just no difference, that only a Republican president needs to come in and correct things. And I'm sorry. I mean, I was around when Nixon pulled his junk. And I, at that time, had supported Nixon. And I was shocked that something like that could happen. More conservative people in my atmosphere also were shocked. And now the nation is in a different state. People are not shocked at this stuff. I have supported Republican presidencies somewhat until recently, when there's too many lies going on and too many believing falsehoods.
Bill, thanks for the call. We're just about out of time. Elisa, is there something different now? We're less able to be shocked, as Bill says, than we were in the times of Nixon.
I think to a certain extent, yeah, there has been indications that, you know, a lot of these things that would be, you know, jaw-dropping scenarios are just simply, you know, brushed over for the next news event of the day. And so whether it's a product of this time or, you know, any one particular person, it's unclear, but certainly it is a different day and age, certainly.
Thanks to everyone for calling in. And Elisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Been talking to Elisa von Hagel, professor of political science at UW-Superior. She joined us for a closer look at yesterday's January 6th hearings, how they fit into the overall pattern of the hearings so far. None now until after the July 4th holiday scheduled by the January 6th committee. We'll watch for that schedule and share it with you when we know when we're going to be airing those. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. A lot of people are dealing with autoimmune disorders, and they can be difficult to diagnose and treat. Find out what causes them and hear about the latest research. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. And you can find more great conversations about health on the Central Time archives. I just heard yesterday about the latest in migraine research, very common condition, maybe affecting you or someone you know. And another great conversation on gut health a couple weeks back. Find all of this stuff at WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk with a composer and conductor of a Pulitzer Prize-winning piece of music that debuted last Thanksgiving in a cathedral in Milwaukee. Now, insects are everywhere. They're in our gardens, lawns, and homes. The only place they haven't been discovered on Earth is deep, deep in saltwater oceans. They're also a big part of human culture. They star in movies, think Ant-Man and Bug's Life. They influence fashion and even lead to new technologies. Barrett Klein is a biology professor at UW-La Crosse. He studies entomology and the relationship between insects and human culture. Barrett, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have, I understand, an origin story that led you to a lifelong pursuit of the science and art of insects. What is it?
Wow, I guess one origin story is that I was 5 years old and I found a dead insect in my parents' driveway. And I was struck by the beauty. I come from a family of artists, and having this accessible, handleable, gorgeous butterfly dead in my hands inspired I had an epiphany. I knew that insects would play a central role in my life, just didn't know how.
Now, you do the science of insects, also art, and you discovered that you're not the only person to have that epiphany. Can you talk a little bit about the long tradition of human culture and art being inspired by the world of insects and other arthropods?
Indeed. In fact, we can go back to the beginnings and before the beginnings of human evolution to look at connections primates have had with insects and the earliest hominids had with insects in a variety of forms. For example, simply the eating of insects or the living with of insects. Eating of insects traditionally, actually, let me ask you, how many insect species do you think humans traditionally consume?
On purpose?
Yeah, on purpose.
I don't know. I would guess that is
an excellent qualifier because the Federal Drug Administration allows certain parts per thousand or million of insects and orange juice and countless other things that we consume. So all of us are entomophagists to some extent.
I would guess probably a low number, like 12 or 20 species. I'm guessing I'm way low on ones we eat on purpose.
A couple magnitudes off. A very conservative estimate would be 1,611 by a recent publication, as in a month or two ago. But that's a very conservative estimate because traditional practices, for example, in Oaxaca, Mexico, number 146 species of insects alone used today.
Now, you do art, and you are inspired by the insect world. What kind of things do you do?
Oh, a lot. I used to do scientific illustration, and I still do to some extent today, but I used to make natural history displays at a studio in Missouri and then at the American Museum of Natural History, and I was hired on essentially as an entomologist who creates art. So I fused the science and art in a way that could inspire or educate the public. So I mold cast sculptures of insects I made, paint them to put them on display in dioramas, but also thermographic videos. What I'm really excited recently in producing are sculptures made from insect products. So I keep some honeybee hives, and I might stick a bicycle helmet in there, an old broken bicycle helmet, see how they build on that, and then collaborate with them. Build with more beeswax to produce these elaborate helmets.
I'm going to ask for a brief answer to a huge question. Can you talk about just the range of symbolism that bugs offer in art, in the art world, in different cultures? It's not all just, ooh, bugs, icky.
Yeah, so symbolism can take many different forms, and we can reach into ancient Egyptian symbols, for example, in mythology, all the way to symbols today. And I'll go backwards. Nah, I'll go forwards. I'll start chronologically. So if we think about Khepri, the god of in ancient Egyptian mythology, the symbol is a dung beetle, the sacred scarab beetle that would roll the spherical ball of dung, like a celestial body, the sun, across the sky. To today, you could go to Enterprise, Alabama, and see the herald of prosperity in the form of a boll weevil beetle being held aloft by a statue because they celebrate this pest or this insect that would destroy a crop so that they would... It basically caused them to be more enterprising and look to other crops for their success stories. And they recognize that. But you'll also find insects on currencies around the world. My wedding ring is made of a Greek coin that's 2,000 years old with a honeybee on it. But you have currency both in coin and bill form that feature insects for various reasons, and postal stamps and beyond.
We'll leave it there for now, but I hope we can talk more about this in the future. Barrett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Barrett Klein, professor of biology at UW-La Crosse. We talked with Barrett about how bugs, insects influence human culture and art. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about caring for the ones we love.
Many of us reach a point in life when it's our turn to take care of our parents. That was the case for Hedy Lamarr Rudd, whose father, Lavelle, had an enormous impact on her life and left a lasting impression on everyone who knew him. She shares their story at the UW Continuing Studies Writers Institute.
My father, Lavelle F. Rudd, had replacement parts all over his body. His hips were replaced and he still tried to straddle a motorcycle. The source of his fragility and his strength was a diagnosis of lupus that he received when he was released from prison around 1978. I remember his being angry at first because he didn't know what was wrong. His fingers hurt, he said. I remember him saying, "How does a black man go to the doctor and cry that his fingers hurt?" Eventually, his already dark fingers turned black with gangrene, resulting in the amputation of most of them. A musician, a writer, a mechanic, a lover, my father found ways to use those nubs to accomplish his goals, but he was never the same. Fingers gone, hips replaced, knees next, and then the glorious day when he received a halo, a contraption that surrounded his chest with bars up to and surrounding his skull to keep his neck and spine from moving. One day, he grew very sick, slipping into a coma. He was brought to Mariner Hospital rather than University Hospital, which is where he was normally treated. A few hours later, the phone rang. Miss Rudd, this is Mariner Hospital. Your father has checked himself out. Excuse me, I said. He was just in a coma. How could he check himself out? The doctor went on to explain that he had awakened shortly after we left and demanded to be released. They told him that he was in no position to be released and explained why he had been admitted. So as soon as he was left alone, he unplugged his IV tubes, put on a multicolored robe, hospital slippers, and walked out of the hospital. We followed his elusive trail on foot and by car, looking everywhere. While it should have been easy to find an elderly black man wearing a Moses robe, it was more difficult than we expected. We returned home to wait for a call from the police, who we hoped would have better luck than we did. When the call came, we rushed to the hospital, and there sat my dad in a wheelchair with a mischievous grin on his face. The officers explained that they had found him at the Citgo gas station in East Washington. We later found out the little devil had a brain aneurysm, which is how he found himself wearing the halo. Over 100 hip locations, dislocations later, the doctors at University Hospital accused him of purposely dislocating his hip in order to obtain prescription drugs. My dad responded that he could buy much better drugs on the street. To which they chalked him up as a drug addict and began to treat him as such. One resident orthopedic doctor decided that rather than continue to put his hip in place again after being admitted twice in a 24-hour period for separate dislocations, he would put the hip back in and then place a plaster cast around my father's torso. The episode crushed his spirit. A few months later, he was back in the hospital. When I went to visit him, he said, "I shouldn't have woken up this morning. I don't think I will tomorrow." I remember once telling him that I never wanted him to die, and he said he would let me know when he was going to die. I told him that's not how it worked, and in that moment, I told him, "I'll be back to see you the next day." The call came at 3 a.m. that he was finally free. He had kept his promise to me and let me know that it was his time. So after the funeral, we cremated my father. I thought about my father's gifts to the world, his writing, his music, and the memories that others carried of him inside of their hearts. I didn't know if he was in heaven or hell, but I knew that what he left behind was as important as what we lost when he left. And I promised myself that I would live that kind of life, and that when I leave the planet, people will know that I was here. The last promise to keep is mine.
Hedy Lamarr Rudd's story came to us from the UW Odyssey Project, where low-income adults find their voices and earn college credit in an English literature course. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Coming up, the first Native American to win a Pulitzer Prize for Music tells us about a piece he composed specifically for a Milwaukee cathedral and its pipe organ. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist in Milwaukee and its organ provided the setting for a prize-winning performance last fall. Voiceless Mass is an all-instrumental, non-traditional piece composed specifically for the space. It debuted at a concert held on Thanksgiving. Raven Chacon composed it. He's an Albuquerque-based composer, performer, and installation artist from Fort Defiance, Navajo Nation. When his Voiceless Mass won the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for Music last month, he became the first Native American to receive that award. Also with us, David Bloom, co-artistic director and conductor for Present Music, a Milwaukee-based organization that was among the groups that commissioned the work. I talked with both of them earlier today. Raven, let's start with you. First of all, congratulations on the Pulitzer. And can you tell us how you approached this unique project, composing a piece specifically for this unique space?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I was really happy to be invited by Present Music to compose a new piece over the pandemic. You know, as we know, everything was up in the air in terms of if we'd be having concerts, if anything would be in person. And so, you know, I was really excited to be making a new work. And once I learned that it was to be written using the church organ there at the cathedral, this became a new, you know, possibility for me to think about what this piece might might mean and what it might be about.
David, can you tell us how this commission came about for Voiceless Mass?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Present Music, I'm one of the two co-artistic directors, and Eric Zegnitz and I were just really taken with Raven's music and his ideas that he puts into his art. And so we said, you know, we just went to Raven and said, basically wrote him a piece of fan mail and said, how can we do your music? How can we work on something new? And what would you want to make? And so he said, we told him a bit about our programs, and he pointed to this one that we do in this cathedral, and said, now that sounds interesting. So we were very thrilled to hear about that.
And this is going to be, as I understand it, Raven, for a Thanksgiving performance. Can you talk a little bit about your reaction, your thinking about that timing?
Yeah, it seems like very often I get asked to respond to that anniversary of Thanksgiving. And of course, this is a date every year that Indigenous people in North America, you know, question. And we wonder, you know, what does it mean for us to be involved in the celebration on this date? At the same time, you know, this is a time to gather. Families gather, they have meals together. And so I think all Native people in this country, you know, have a conflict inside of them about what that anniversary means. And so for me to have an invitation to make a piece of music that's going to be premiered on that date, and thinking about the setting of where this is to take place in a Catholic cathedral, and thinking about the history of Indigenous people, my own tribe, with this institution and on this date, you know, all came together in the statement that this music composition makes.
David, can you paint us a visual picture of the setting here, the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist in Milwaukee, and this Nichols and Simpson organ?
Right. Yeah. So the cathedral is this gorgeous space that Present Music has played in for, you know, 25 years, something like that, annually. So Raven invited us, the ensemble, to spread our 12 musicians throughout the cathedral. So we, we put our violinists way in the back, our clarinetists and flutist on the sides, you know, cellist on the side. So we, basically the work surrounds the audience, and depending on where you're sitting, it's a different experience of the piece. And there are two kind of sources for the organ sound, one in the front of the cathedral and one in the back in a balcony. And so that again is a way that the audience is surrounded by the sound that Raven created.
We're talking about a unique musical composition, a unique musical event that took place in Milwaukee. The composer just won a Pulitzer Prize for it. With us, the composer, Raven Chacone, and David Bloom with Present Music. I want to get a taste of that performance here. I'm going to give a listen. Excerpt from Voiceless Mass there. Raven, can you talk a little bit about what we were just hearing and how it all came together to create this, like, I guess, audioscape in this setting?
Well, using the organ was, you know, such a great opportunity, because you have this full range of pitches, almost to the inaudible lows to the inaudible highs. And so I wasn't approaching the organ in any kind of, maybe like you would hear in Baroque music, any kind of complex melodies or fast runs. In fact, you're just hearing kind of tones dispersed across the composition, and these are supported by the tones that the other instruments are making. One of these instruments is electronic sine tones, which are also capable of being very, you know, inaudible in the low ends and on the upper register, but kind of producing this physical feeling inside of the listener, this kind of this weight, especially in the low end, or this presence that something is there, but you can't quite hear it. And so this makes its way across the composition in different spatial configurations and at different volumes, but overall becoming this kind of unified drone that you hear throughout.
And David, I understand you conducted the actual performance here. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like with this unique piece, the space, and as you mentioned, the musicians scattered around the building?
Yeah. Well, it's always fun to, you know, conduct an ensemble that's 360 degrees around you. So that was my experience for this piece, kind of seeking out the players throughout the house, including, or the narthex, including just like a football field away almost. But the process of kind of creating this performance was a really deeply collaborative one, which I really, really appreciate Raven's openness to our ideas as an ensemble. In fact, the work invites improvisation and just the creativity of the ensemble and the musicians. So it was very gratifying to play the piece from that perspective as well.
And Raven, the title again is Voiceless Mass. Now, literally, it's voiceless. There's nobody singing or talking or anything as part of it. Does it mean more than that, the voiceless part of this?
Yeah. You know, I wanted to consider this building where we were performing the music inside of, and the history of the Catholic Church and other institutions, not limited to the church. I mean, I'm thinking of universities even, where there is the idea that all voices have equity and have the potential to speak, but at the same time, there can be a lot of suppression that happens in these places, and there might only be a positioning of a single voice, even though the intention was for a group of people to be able to express themselves. And so that's what this piece addresses, and it makes available a situation where there's equitable voices. So you have the viola in this instance being probably the quietest instrument in the ensemble, and providing a space where that viola can have the same voice or the same power of voice as, let's say, the organ. And to be able to talk about this through instrumental music is difficult. You know, there are no words. There is no libretto or spoken word to be able to talk about, you know, this history. And this history for me comes from the viewpoint of being an Indigenous person. But so to be able to put that into an instrumental piece of music and have that understood by, you know, let's say the Pulitzer Committee and the broader public is quite an honor. And I'm really happy that I was able to, you know, collaborate with Present Music and have this dialogue with the church. You know, this was commissioned by the United Church of Christ, and that they were open to my ideas on this is I'm very honored.
Raven, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
And David, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was David Bloom and Raven Chacon. Raven is a composer, performer, and installation artist from Navajo Nation. And David is a co-artistic director and conductor for Present Music. I talked to them earlier today about the piece Voiceless Mass, which Present Music co-commissioned Raven to write for a Thanksgiving concert at the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist in Milwaukee. Fast forward to last month, Raven received the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for Music for that performance, for that composition, becoming the first Native American to get that award. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll visit the Upper Mississippi River with a big new study that looks at the impact of higher water levels, a changing ecosystem, and a warmer climate. We'll find out how that part of the big river has changed over the years. The Underground Railroad helped black people escape slavery in the United States. We'll answer a Why Scotson question about the Underground Railroad here in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll look at some of the latest news on the U.S.-Mexico border, including a massive tragedy. A number of people died while being smuggled through Texas illegally. We'll find out how that fits into the wider picture of immigration law and border enforcement. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.